We've made a modification again of our title this morning. The original program said the Garden of the Soul, the Life of Contemplation. And we will, of course, indicate at the end that contemplation is really the climax of this understanding of this symbolism in our hearts. But if we are contemporary, then we have to face straight on this whole question of sexuality. And certainly the theme of the Garden of the Soul is a sexual motif that we find both in the Old Testament and indeed throughout the history of the church, especially in the 12th century, which we'll focus on as well, because in the 12th century there was this whole aberration of courtly love, very much like the aberration of sex in our culture today. Both of them a distortion of the reality of true human love and certainly of the divine. We hinted the other day that there was, in fact, a connection between sexuality and spirituality. But Scott Peck, in his book, The Road Less Traveled, faces this straight on. And in fact, in our secular society, he puts it very bluntly. He says, for many people, the only true religious experience that they've ever had was orgasm. And of course, that shocks us. But I think, as one thinks more deeply about it, there's certainly an element of truth in what he's saying. And so he observes very kindly, in view of the sex-obsessed society that we live in, that those lost in compulsive-driven pursuit of sex are in fact looking for spirituality. They don't know it. They're blind to it. We come back again to that Greek blindness of tragedy that doesn't really know what it's doing. And I'm more and more convinced that perhaps the murmuring, quiet prayer of our Lord throughout his life remained, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And when we look at our own lives and the tragedy of our lives, we have to recognize the blindness of our drivenness that we didn't understand. That drivenness we need then to look at this morning. So it's true that in sexuality, as in spirituality, people are looking for love. They're looking for wholeness. Hence, there's great passion for union, seeking for meaning in life. There we can, in a sense, sum up the basic needs, drives of our restlessness, looking for love, looking for integrity in our life, and certainly looking for the desire for meaning in our life. These are the three great desires, then, of the human being. We could also add, of course, looking for significance, to provide further that security in our lives. And to be loved is profoundly to be significant. And so I become more and more convinced in my own pastoral ministry that all of us need both healing of our sexuality as well as of our spirits. And that to try and deal with the one without the other is certainly not getting deep enough. Yet the tragedy within the religious life of so many of us is the schizophrenic culture that we live with that splits these two realms apart, so that on the one hand there is the hiding of sexual shame, or an alternative way of doing the same thing is the religious condemnation and guilt that we both feel and feel imposed upon. Or even in assuming celibacy to be a greater love for God. or in even the necessity of sexual repression for the love of God. A whole generation of young Christian men can be influenced by some guru who himself has homosexual tendencies, but who are taught that they're obviously having the superior life if they remain single. And so the motive and the proposition of what should be our vocation is something that God alone can give us, because when it's given by men or man, it's distorted. And of course, one of the things that creates a lot of confusion in our life is this necessity of sexual repression for the love of God. And again, this can be a banner that sounds wonderful, but again, we need to map it out. We need to explore it in order to understand our whole biography and understand the whole context in which such attitudes are being conveyed. At the same time, it's obvious that there's a profound fear of sex in our lives. So that it's typical, really, of the history of legislation to see how sexual offense has been put by us so deeply into the core of our ethical prohibitions. It's almost as if, though we theoretically know that pride may be chief of the cardinal sins, nevertheless, we're not really convinced it is. We're much more likely to see that which is most offensive to be that which is most sexual. One of the things that is very interesting is that when we see the age in which Jesus lived, he's not out in a campaign against pornography. The sexual immoral life is not something that Jesus seems to take very much notice about. It's almost as if his gentle forgiveness of prostitutes and sinners is, well, it is, of course, an offense to the scribes and Pharisees. They can't understand why this teacher of righteousness seems to be somewhat indifferent to what they so centrally see as vital. And it's something to reflect upon and to ask ourselves why. Could it be that often those who are most repressive of sexuality are those who are most starved of love themselves? And certainly we see the lovelessness of the scribe and Pharisee portrayed in the Gospels. In other words, perhaps what is needed far more is a rechanneling of the need of love rather than the damming up of the need of love. And Jesus rechannels back to its right source and to its right objective, divine love in the human heart. And so it's characteristic of society that it has tended to build up legislative efforts to protect itself by its control of sexual behavior. We don't need to look far in the history of sexual laws to realize that underlying such legislation are often more the motives about the context of property interests, or of household structures. Certainly, the preservation of the family is vital, but if it's the preservation of the family more than the understanding of what expresses the family in love, it's misunderstood. Or again, the notion of individual rights And of course, here women do have a cause for injustice. That so often notions of societal legislation have been the protection of the male interests. It's been so often characteristic that it's the prostitute that has been persecuted, not the customer. In other words, the history of legislation tends to show a lack of real insight of concern for true love. And so perhaps the whole history of legalizing sexuality in the Western world has revolved around these three basic patterns of sexual behavior, each of which is a half-truth. But it's not the whole truth. So what is licit in sex is its reproductive function. Be fruitful and multiply. Marriage is for the procreation of children. And there is, of course, some element of bias, one can see, often in the Old Testament about this. So that certainly in the earlier period, as we find with the patriarchs, that if a wife was unfruitful, it was legitimate, as we know in the case of the story of Abraham and of the adoption of concubinage to provide for those children. And that the monogamous relationship was relative to fruitfulness. The boundaries then of the chastity of one love were somewhat flexible. And one senses that the flexibility was related to this one primary objective, to be fruitful, have children. Then secondly, the notion that sex is impure, so it is a source of shame and defilement. And that seems certainly to be one of the consequences that we see in the story of the fall, that Adam and Eve were both naked, and in the presence of the Lord, they were quite unaware of their nakedness. It was when they were rebels away from the presence of the Lord that now their nakedness becomes apparent to them. And then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. That symbolism is rich in meaningfulness. The third, and of course it's the nature too, of course, of our fallen sexuality, that there's always this element of hiding. And we see, of course, we're living in that kind of transition where there's far more nudity than ever before, that's unrepentant and unabashed, promiscuity and the eroticism of today. But nevertheless, there is still a deep hiding behind it all as to the significance of what sexuality means. Then thirdly, the legal development of sanctions of sexuality in lieu of relational guidance and nurture in the love of God has, of course, always been characteristic of fallen society. So our own efforts, even as Christians in the Supreme Court or indeed any other court in our generation, to uphold the legality of standards is in itself only a propping up of something that is something subsidiary, really, to the vital need of renewal of spirit that society needs. But all of these three, which have been so dominant a pattern in the history of our Western society, are now all questioned in the sexual revolution. If you read some of the more recent books, such as the book by Christopher Lash on the cult of narcissism, and also, of course, the Gallup poll surveys, it does seem as if there's been a significant paradigmatic shift since the breaking of further boundaries in the 1960s. I don't think it's only the 1960s. Virginia Woolf in 1905 observed that there was a significant shift that had taken place. And she's referring, I think, to the publication in the previous year, 1904, of the book by the philosopher G.E. Moore, M-O-O-R-E, in which a whole new interpretation of the breaking of boundaries, moral boundaries, was being sanctioned in the interests of asceticism. So the Bloomsbury Circle, as it began to develop around these avant-garde artistic, philosophical intellectuals living totally irresponsibly in experimenting with promiscuity and homosexuality long before it was common practice in the rest of society, has certainly been a great thrust forward of this whole further rebellion that the 1960s have brought about. So we really live in a time of moral reconstruction. We live at a time then when just simply building our sandcastles before these encroaching tides of lawlessness need to be deeply re-examined. So let's turn to see, again, some of our insights from the ancient world in order to apply them for the contemporary situation, because they are being integrated by the secular world if we're not seeing them. The peoples of the ancient Near East, they did see, perhaps dimly, a connection between sex and the sublime. Frequently, they described religious fulfillment in terms of having experienced sexual ecstasy. So they worshiped great goddesses as the apotheosis of their sexual ideals. Michener, in one of his novels, The Spring, deals with this very issue, where this young man from the country is brought in to the cult of the Canaanites and is initiated by the priestess in the temple, and he's given a whole new transference of life. And certainly the whole cult of temple prostitution was this kind of initiatory ceremony that was offered as a very powerful force of idolatry in the ancient world. And it seems that particularly influential were the goddesses of Phoenicia, goddesses that have been brought from over the sea, probably from the Minoan civilization, where we do get this very strong focus on the fertility cult of the mother goddess. But now, in the form of Ishtar and Astarte, they are brought in. And their cults offered their devotees opportunities to celebrate the joys of physical love and its power to transfigure sensual pleasure into something that was beyond the humdrum and the commonplace. Isn't that still the temptation of today? And for the Greeks, Aphrodite seems to perform the same role, at least in the earlier part of Greek civilization. What is interesting, however, is to see the tension that arises, certainly with the rise of Greek philosophy, that saw the necessity to control passion in the interests of reason. We tend to think of Epicurus, of course, as the apex of this Epicurean philosophy of pleasure. But even Epicurus was critical of the snares of erotic love, saying sexual intercourse has never done a man good, and he's lucky if it has not harmed him. So there was an ambiguity. In fact, there was a tendency to definitely repress eroticism in the teachings of the philosophers. And the impact of that teaching, and no doubt especially the Stoics' teaching that was total repression of sex, was to distinguish between Aphrodite, Urania, given these higher idealistic, more rational values of the celestial qualities of love and affection, from Aphrodite, Pandemos, the patroness of prostitution, which of course the lower class were assumed always to indulge in. So we find that Plato, and certainly later philosophers, certainly Aristotle, were much more repressive. Plato is fundamentally ambiguous. Aristotle is definitely repressive. And these two streams of thought reinforced certainly on the repressive side by the Stoics. Downplaying the role of human love and upplaying the role of human intellect. But for society at large, the lewdness of life is clearly echoed in the New Testament injunctions, especially those of Paul's epistles, where the indictment against porneia, which is left vague, we're never given any explicit description as to what fornication means, but the implications are clear from the context of his injunctions that it is against all non-marital sex in all its forms. And the world in which he lived certainly needed that. If you think of the Latin language of Roman society, there are at least 25 synonyms that were current in Latin language for fornication. Within the Christian world, a vast transformation began to take place. And by the mid-5th century, continence was now given pride of place in Christian society. And celibacy had introduced a new elitism. And this remained supreme throughout the Middle Ages until the Reformation. That the celibate state was definitely the better state right up till the Reformation. And as I say, rather tongue-in-cheek, when the monk Luther married and made an Augustinian monastery his home. Turned things on their head in more ways than one. And I wonder, it's worth exploring, whether it's precisely in this age of celibacy, from the 5th century to the 16th century, whether the cult of the virgin is not to be interpreted, at least in part, as a concomitance of celibacy. In a sense, it's the virgin that seems to be more the exemplar of the Christian life than Christ himself. Though again, it was not unnoticed to medieval Christians that Christ too was celibate. And that this was in fact the luminous inversion of the dark side of the flesh in Eve. It stood for all that is sensual and seductive. When we turn to the Old Testament, we see that the Old Testament is certainly fully aware of the power of the sexual, the primacy of love, and at the same time of the pathology of the disorders of sexual aberration. So what is impressive is this frankness, frank attention, openness that is given to the love relationship between a man and a woman. So that in the biography, for example, of Jacob, his love for Rachel more than for Leah is, of course, not only openly admitted, but explains why he spends another 7 years with his father-in-law. And Michael unabashedly has recorded her great love for David, even though it's all mixed up with Saul's own military ambitions, and makes a deal with David that he has to slay 100 Philistines if he's going to get his daughter's hand. And clearly, loyalty to a good woman is the obvious morality that is spelled out as wisdom in the book of Proverbs. And there's both hints and clear prohibition of the practice of temple prostitution. It is viewed indeed as incest before Yahweh. So this peculiar story that has often troubled commentators about sons of God marrying with the daughters of men is now considered by most commentators to be definitely of this nature, the prohibition of the very thing that was being practiced by the Philistines and the Phoenician ports. And again, the aberrations of love beyond boundaries of family life, as Amnon's incestuous love for Tamar, or indeed the condemnation of homosexuality and other forms of sexual debasement, are all dealt with very explicitly. So Scripture is perfectly frank about all such sexual disorders. But where it all begins is profoundly taught in the prototypal history of the Garden of Eden. So it's clearly in this first story of the Bible that the fall implies that man's broken relationship with his Creator leads to man's own brokenness with his wife and within his own family. What is intrinsic to the ontology of man is that though he comes from the dust, yet owing his life to the divine inspiration, God breathing upon that dust. Therefore, human autonomy becomes incompatible with man's true nature. So then a trusting, dependent relationship upon his Creator lies at the center of man's own being. And when this is broken, then there's a sense in which all hell is let loose. All chaos can only be the consequence of the rejection of the Creator. And therefore his own sexuality is called into question. Distrust, shame, transference of personal responsibility are all part of the story. And at the heart of the story is, of course, the distancing now between man and the presence of the Lord. In other words, the whole motif of the garden, of that enclosure, of its boundedness, of its restraints, are in the context of obedience to God. For man is placed in the Lord's garden. Sexuality is under the lordship of Christ. Human relationships owe their inspiration and indeed their mandate from the presence of God. And so the story opens with a recognition that it is not good for man to be alone. Man has been occupied in naming all the animals, and he's observed in the naming thereof that they're all in pairs. He's not paired off. And it's almost as if the naming of the animals is to look quintessentially at all the intrinsic traits of each of these animals, but none of them fits the human condition. None of them is suitable for human companionship. So it's as if man is given the opportunity of looking through all creation for a helpmeet, and there isn't one on the human level. There's nothing that can be a substitute for the archetypal relationship of man with his Creator. And so when woman is given to him, it's out of his own being that she comes. Rib from his own body. Bone of his bone. Flesh of his flesh. And of course both implicitly created then in the Imago Dei. Yet the one who alone can fit this need is also the one who leads him into temptation. And the very fact that she takes the initiative is itself a reversal of the ordering that God has of the delegation of divine authority. He should have taken initiative, it's she who takes it. And the roles are reversed in confusion. And their own unself-consciousness in their nakedness is also reversed, so that their sexual distinctiveness now becomes one of shame. Discord then replaces harmony, mutual trust, to one of suspicion. In Milton's Paradise Lost, where this theme, of course, is most imaginatively explored, Milton interprets that the motive that Eve had arose out of the insecurity of her own identity. Adam could know who he was. He was directly created by God to be in his image and likeness. So Milton is really postulating that Eve says, well, I came from Adam indirectly. I'm representative of the Imago Dei, but only indirectly. So who am I? And it's her quest for self-identity, says Milton, that created her lust for self-love. for narcissistic love. And so we certainly find in classical and medieval imagery that one of the elements of the garden of love, but this is now of course sensual love, is the pool of Narcissus that is always there at the heart of the garden. And of course we see today in all the sexual confusion of our times that one of the strong motivations of our society is this quest for self-fulfillment, this quest for self-identification, this lostness as to who I am. So he sees the scenario of Eve as one of narcissism and of weakness, we should put the A in there, on the part of Adam. He doesn't fulfill his God-given gift of authority and leadership, of headship, but of weakness. It's the husband who is to love his wife as Christ loved the church. That's not arrogance. That's not bossiness when we think of headship. My wife often says, if my husband really loved me as Christ loved the church, then I would do anything for him. So the biblical account is speaking then of conjoint disobedience. The very roles and the motives that they may have for those roles are both in distrust of the Word of God. Later, we find in the Middle Ages, as we shall see, that the garden in its idealistic Christian form is really the garden of a good conscience. Bernard of Clairvaux tells us the garden of a good conscience is really the garden of obedience to the Word of God. All of life is directed by the Word, in union with the Word. Therefore, in union with the will of God. But willfulness is linked with disobedience to a denial of the veracity and the commands of the Word. Has God said? So what the Garden of Eden is declaring that, in fact, without expulsion, the garden becomes a grave. And later, in the imagery, often there was this dual association of the garden with the place of death. Yes, there was a grave in the garden, but Jesus rises from that grave. Adam was reminded that though he was spirated from the dust, to dust he would return. So this double entendre, this second motif that we now find, of course, in the Gospels, of the second Adam, who rises from that garden tomb for our redemption, is, of course, another part of the story. The symbolism of the garden of love is, of course, rich indeed, far richer than most of us explore in our generation. But basically, what is being sustained, especially in the Song of Songs, is that human sexuality is like the very nature of man himself, his personhood, his humanism. They are all fundamentally sustained by God's presence. Without God's presence, our lives are dusty indeed. And so the theme of the garden is that it's all eloquently expressive of the fertility, the productivity, the fecundity that the garden represents because of the presence of the Lord. Remove his presence and the garden disappears comes the wilderness. That's the theme, really, the biblical theme of the garden. Certainly becomes perverted and corrupted. And so the Song of Songs is replete in such imagery of the hortus clusus. That is to say, the enclosed garden. It's of course many things at once. I say the enclosed garden of sexuality because there is this theme of the loved one being that enclosed garden. But there's also an awareness, of course, that the enclosure is associated also in the relationship between God and the soul. So foundational is this simple phrase that we may pass over very easily in Eden, that is the garden of the Lord. And notice that just as there's a consistency between the context of the two creation stories of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, in Genesis 1, it's the mightiness of God that brings in creation by his word, by the word of his power, says the apostle, says the psalmist. But in the second narrative of God's special attention to the creation of man, it's Yahweh. It's the covenant God that is being called in. It's that covenant relationship that is expressive of the second creation account. And that the garden of the Lord is expressive of the sphere in which the covenant life between God and his people can be nurtured, can be communicated. So the garden of the covenant Lord is how we can think of this idyllic representation that is being communicated. And indeed it was characteristic of the monarch in the ancient Near East for the king to have his own park or garden. So that it's often associated then with the king's palace, or at least his summer house, where he is in recreation. And another symbol, we get an echo of it very strongly in Ezekiel 28, where we have a recurrence of the story of Eden and the fall of man because of pride, and pride is much more strongly recognized as expressive of the king of Tyre and his expulsion from Eden, that there's a symbol also of the mount, or the mountain, within the garden, suggesting the cultic role of worship. We celebrate the presence of God. We celebrate the adoration and the worship that is due to his name. Though again, the aberration of this in false worship is also indicted by the prophet Isaiah. As we've already seen, the bounds placed upon the garden as an enclosed garden, a protected place, was its raison d'etre. Without that boundary, it would all merge into the wilderness, into the wildness of life, into the chaos of unreality. So what is legislative, what is expressive of obedience to the word of God, is all within that motif of boundedness. The law does have a protective, positive value. And of course, the motif of the garden of love, of sexual love, requires therefore likewise monogamy, requires faithfulness and loyalty. So we can interpret this boundedness at many different levels. And certainly it was protective and prohibitive of the aberrations of sexuality, of relationships. Another element that we find that echoes the garden theme is the remoteness of the garden. Where exactly is it? Geography is never quite clear. But perhaps its remoteness is also expressive of the mystery of the soul and the inwardness of the related life. Its locale is known to God. As a paradise within the happier far than we can ever locate, says Milton. It's clear, of course, as we've already seen, that it's a sphere of human involvement with God, as well as of man and women, or man and woman in their sexuality. So, just as we said at the beginning of our discourse this morning, we can never separate sexuality from spirituality in the life of the Christian. So we see that, biblically, there's a constant movement between the two levels of reality. Man's relationship with God and man's relationship sexually one with the other. You know, on a very practical basis in married love, married life, what a profound difference there would be for many marriages if the last thing that one did at night in bed was to pray together. And that praying together for a vowed life would imply that any quarrel, any disruption of relationship during the day had to be dealt with before one could pray together. And if one thought, as Christians, of the sexual act in life as being a source of worship and of prayerfulness, how different again would the aberrations and the pathologies of our sexual life be transformed. So, this is what I think is implied by the recognition that we can't afford to exercise our sexual life without the contemplative life. It's obvious when you think about the biblical framework for it. It's revolutionary for our society today. The many metaphors, then, of both a relationship with God and the relationship that we have in sexual life are all then spelt out in this other vivid imagery. Afraid now and again I haven't gone over the spelling. Watered and irrigated is certainly the motif that we find right at the beginning. Eden is abundantly irrigated. One river that becomes four great rivers that goes out to all the nations as well. And therefore, the cornucopia of fecundity is present. And all the imagery of flowers and herbs and fruits spell out its multifaceted prosperity and fruitfulness. So when you destroy the garden, you've destroyed everything. It's nothing but desolation, death, if the garden is eliminated. Take away love from the human life, and what is there but death? But the corruption is most devastating also, therefore, in the garden. Precisely the seduction of love and the corruption of love that is the worst form of human corruption, because it's the source of all other corruptions. And so Marvel, in his poem, The Garden, speaks of course, the human garden without God, where substituting all the biblical imagery and now the perverted images, the pool frequented by Narcissus, the castle built by jealousy, the perfumes of erotic seduction, and indeed all the flowers and the fruits of the garden now become the passions of fallen man. What Marvel is really describing is based very much on a Latin poet, Claudian, who long before him had imagined all of this in very much a Roman context of the corruption of Roman society. And so likewise, in Christian allegory, the trees of the Lord that give shade and rest in sound doctrine become in pagan allegory the enchanted forest of addiction and the entrapment of these addictions. We're just discovering today that much of what is called love in our carnal society is in fact not love at all. We even talk about the addiction of love. It's really sexual addiction. Another theme that is characteristic of this imagery is to view the garden as the sphere that is refreshing for the recreation of man's spirit. Sometimes becoming much more reductionistic, as it later became in the later formal and geometrically designed gardens. When you think about it, the gardens of the Tuileries or Versailles are much more expressive of René Descartes than the Old Testament. That formalism is rational. It's mathematical. It's all the spirit of what Pascal used to spit out with indignation. Seton, coming from that man that's nameless, because everybody knows who Descartes is. So the ambiguity of the garden is, of course, when it becomes a human artifact, man-made, and where, in rebellion to God, it becomes a secular garden. Then what should be benevolence becomes malevolence, and they're never very far apart. I can't begin to imagine the broken hearts of the gardens of Versailles, of the intrigue of the court, of all the double talk, gossip, prostitution of life that we think of associated with these formal gardens. But the scripture indicates that precisely because the garden is the place for the worship of God, that the impurification that takes place, the profanation, is most serious. And so Uzziah's profanation of the temple was in medieval literature often likened to Adam's expulsion from Eden, where garden and temple express the same reality of sanctity, of reverence, true worship in the light of divine residence and presence. So another theme that we find in the garden is the restoration in the light of eschatological joy, anticipating the age to come. Then the true marital bliss will be of the Lamb and of his bride, as John the seer envisions in the New Jerusalem. Then blessing and fertility will be fully manifested. So, as one concludes before the break, these echoes of biblical allusions, imagery, to how they were further elaborated in the medieval life. One of the things that is so impressive is the strong tradition that begins with Origen, that is taken up by Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory the Great, and that then reaches its apogee in the 12th century in Bernard of Clairvaux, continued by his companion William of Saint-Thierry, his successor John of Ford. And so in the 12th century you have this extraordinary explosion of commentary on the Song of Songs. Never was there a period in the history of the church when the Song of Songs was more focused upon in the 12th century. But to turn to the song itself, and by the way, one of the most useful little commentaries that I've come across, and there's an awful lot of confusion written about the Song of Songs, but G. Lloyd Carr in the Intervaste commentary is excellent, Song of Solomon. It's one of the most useful summaries of all the confused thinking about the place and the message and the meaning of the Song of Songs. And so what we find in that song is that it's a geographical garden. This is the tension about the garden imagery. We don't know quite where it is, but the reality is there. What all this inwardness of soul and where our soul resides in the presence of the Lord is a specific reality because it belongs to you and me. So yes, south of Jerusalem somewhere is the locale for the Song of Songs. And it's significant that the places which are referred to in the song are never allegorical, they're geographical. So Jerusalem and Lebanon and many other places are referred to. But the second reality, which is primary, of course, is that it is the garden of the Lord, as we find in Genesis. That is to say, it's a place where God's presence and dwell in blessing, and we could also say, and God's sovereignty dwell. It's His. It's a royal garden, and therefore, in that context, this whole theme of sovereignty, the sovereignty of love, and the sovereignty of divine love, specifically, of a covenant relationship, is spelled out. And as Lloyd Carr points out, it's probably much more David's song than it is Solomon's song. That it's perhaps what is being eulogized is David's love of his Lord in covenant relationship. It's the covenant of David that takes over in the Old Testament. We never hear of the covenant of Solomon. With 700 wives and goodness knows how many concubines, what kind of covenant love did Solomon know about? So there's a case that is made out for the Song of Songs being the song really of David. But yet it's primarily depicted as an erotic garden where human sexuality is extolled as good indeed. Unabashedly, the desire for love at every level of one's existence, body, soul, and spirit, they're all spelled out quite unabashedly. There is this nakedness of human love seeking the divine that is so beautifully and truthfully being communicated. But how does man love God? What tensions, what uncertainties, what brokenness is also depicted. And so when you look to see the sequence of the commentary, the sequence of the thoughts rather expressed, it's very difficult for many commentators to make sense of the structure of the Song of Songs. And I think that perhaps the best way is to see this exhibition of human love in all its tensions. The anticipation of love that is found and lost and found again. It's like so many of our contemporary Christian courtships. I don't think I've ever experienced in the whole of my life more convolutions of human courtship than in the last few years. In the old days, somehow we plunged into things and that was that. Nowadays, life gets really on one of these, an amusement park, what do you call them, roller coasters, yes. Well, in a sense, the Song of Songs is describing the roller coaster of human courtship. It's consummated, yet once more it's lost, and then found, and finally affirmed. So as I say, it's quite a courtship, even by modern standards. More idealistically, I wonder how much Watchman Nee really did know. But in his commentary, he makes it much more a kind of sequential tram lines kind of affair. Initial love, faltering love, growing love, transforming love, mature love. But nevertheless, what all these commentators are getting out of the story, out of the Song of Songs, is that human relationships with divine love can never be taken for granted. There's no place for moral complacency. There's pain, there's woundedness, there's separation, there's darkness, as well as ecstasy and joy in the reality of it all. Well, I was first drawn myself to the vital importance of the Song of Songs in human life today about 10 years ago when I was ministering to a dear woman in Washington, D.C. who had got divorced. Her husband had left her with callous unfaithfulness after 30 years of marriage. And one knows full well the kind of devastation that arises in the innocent over such a thing like that. And there was a naivety about her innocence of it all. She'd never expected it. Well, I saw her during that period of her recovery. And the thing that was so profoundly moving, it really made a permanent impact on my life, was to see how her recovery was in the Song of Songs. Day after day, month after month, she would diligently read and reread the Song of Songs. And the insights that she gained, that sometimes she shared with me from her journal, have left a permanent impact upon me. That there's no question about the place of the Song of Songs in the canon of the Scriptures. But you see, we, in our evangelical canonicity, have perhaps left it out. And that's why, in our own emotional life, the Song of Songs doesn't really have a place. And so, it's no wonder that in the 12th century, with all the aberration of love that we're going to talk about now after the break, there was a need to recover the Song of Songs. And I believe that in our broken lives today, there needs to be a recovery of the same book with the same message. Because love, physical love, emotional love, spiritual love, they're a real thing in our lives. To deny them is to deny really our humanness. And so if the Lordship of Christ is to make any sense in our lives, then we must enter the garden with him. So let's break now and we'll return to the theme after